This is Jennifer Yushkevich interviewing Krista Ratcliffe on June 3rd, 2018. All right. So, first question, when did you join RSA?
1990.
And what was RSA like when you first joined it?
Well, it was very male and very white. I mentioned that last night in my talk, I believe. And the topics were enthymemes and Kairos and all of this, which I was interested in, but I had been working as a graduate student at Ohio State trying to bring together women's studies and historical rhetoric, Cheryl Glenn, Roxanne Mountford, we were all of a cohort there at Ohio State trying to do this kind of stuff. And Ed Corbett was very supportive. He was not necessarily knowledgeable in how to do it, but he was so not, I mean, he knows more about rhetoric than he's forgotten more about rhetoric than I will ever know. So he was great. But he encouraged us to come. And so we did. But it didn't quite feel like a fit yet. And part of it was that I was very young and not confident and that sort of thing. But part of it was it just had a more traditional feel to it than it does today.
What were some of the main projects or goals of RSA back then? What do you think it was trying to accomplish?
I think it was trying to accomplish interdisciplinary conversations about rhetoric between particularly comm and rec comp, but also, you know, other areas too were welcome. And I think there was a real fervor to make sure that rhetoric was seen as a legitimate enterprise, that it wasn't, you know, anti-intellectual, or that it wasn't irrelevant. It's definitely irreverent. And I think the way to do that in a lot of people's mind at the time was to ground it in the classical stuff, because that has cachet. Yeah, you know? So if you quote Plato, you know, you must be smart. And I don't think it was manipulative in that kind of sense. I just think that's kind of how the grouping went. So there was a lot of classical rhetoric. There was a lot of modern rhetoric.
Do you remember what your first presentation at RSA was about?
I do. It was on the feminist rhetoric of Virginia Woolf. it was. I remember there were two people in the room, and a third person kind of stumbled in and looked around, and I knew the person. And I could just see it on the face. And the person thought, oh, no, I'm going to have to sit down now. So as I said last night, I think that audience member was Biddy. But, and that's part of why I wondered if I belonged. I thought, are people interested in, you know, Virginia Woolf and her rhetorical tactics?
I hope so. That's what I presented yesterday.
Did you? We'll have to talk.
that's definitely one memory. Do you have any other important or prominent memories, either from, you know, the mid-90s or even moving into the 2000s, that just, oh, that was such an RSA moment?
Yeah. I remember going into the, that very first conference in 1990, I remember going in to the keynote and also the luncheon. They used to have luncheons for all of the members. And again, it was the images that stayed with me, as I mentioned last night, the sort of guys with beards. And again, that just kind of made me wonder, do I belong? And so I came a couple more times, but then I had my daughter in the mid-90s, and so I couldn't go to as many conferences, right? So RSA fell by the wayside. And then when Pat Bazelle had her conference in Austin in 2004, I believe, I had not submitted, and she shot me an email. She said, I really need somebody for a panel. She said, would you be interested in doing something like this? And so I sent her a proposal, and off I went. And that was the start of my really being invested, I guess, in RSA. I think I was a little more confident that time. I'd been in the academy a little bit longer. I had my ideas figured out a little bit more concretely so that I could defend them. And then I just, you know, it was just a kind of a second home in some ways. I mean, it became the place where I would come and we could, you know, this group of women would get together. We would just laugh about things, things that would make us, you know, hopping mad at home. We would just sit at the table and we'd laugh till we cried. You know, can you believe this one? And it was really, really, really a wonderful mentoring kind of experience. And it wasn't mentoring in the sense of, you know, somebody being in charge and then everybody doing what that person said. It really was a true kind of collaborative co-mentoring. But as also I mentioned last night, Wynn Horner was, she was fabulous. She had a motto, don't let the bastards get you down. And she recited it on a regular basis. She had gotten that motto from her husband because she was the only faculty member in a department that was not necessarily open to rhetoric and composition at the time, but they needed her to direct composition. So she passed that wisdom on to the rest of us. And she had a wicked sense of humor. She was smart. And she was smart not only in an intellectual way, but she was smart in a strategic kind of way. Okay, got to get more women going. Here's what we've got to do, you know. So she was very inspiring in that way. And I was in a situation where a department wasn't necessarily open to rhetoric and composition all that much. They knew they needed it, but it didn't mean they loved it. And they thought the feminist rhetoric stuff might be a fad. So she took my book under her wing, and she talked me through some of the first book. And she was like, here's where you send it. Here's who you contact. You know, put me down as a reader, that you want me to read it. And she goes, I will. And so she was very much, well, she was very forceful in sort of, you know, saying, you're going to do this. And I did. So I've always kept that in mind and tried to pay it forward.
Is that one of the memories that sort of sticks with you every RSA that
yep.
you, that this,
yep.
this group of women, you kind of just find each other?
Yep. And even if we don't get together in the ways now that we did in the past, because not everybody's around anymore, you know, it's the presence is here. It haunts, and it's wonderful.
Okay, so I know that you went into, you eventually got convinced to go into leadership at
mm-hmm.
RSA. How has the organization changed from when you became first really involved with it through your leadership to now? Because you're president not that long ago, just a couple years.
Yeah, 12 to 14, I believe. I think the way it's changed is twofold. One is I continued a commitment to open it up, both in terms of underrepresented groups being invited in a little bit more, and also different topics and different methods and different theories, you know, being invited in and intentionally, not just kind of hoping the happenstance of a program call, you know, garnered that. So I think that was one element. And then the other is kind of behind the scenes. I developed a strategic plan for the organization. I made the board go through a strategic planning exercise. I made, I don't like the verb made. It's not like I asked and people cooperated with me. to write, all the people who were like chairs of the committees, to write down the processes, because there was this kind of oral tradition of, oh yeah, I did the awards committee. Now here's what I think I did. Now I don't know. And then, you know, it was infuriating to people, because back when it was more of a mom and pop operation with, you know, 300 members or something, you could do that. But when you've got 1,500 members, and you're getting way more applications for programs and for book awards, and all, you can't. That became important to me. People kind of tease me about, you know, my obsession with writing things down, but it makes the process easier. It also, it's kind of a political commitment on my part, because I think if you don't write things down and make them accessible to everybody, then only certain people know. And it's, you know, it's the people that hang out at lunch and talk, and they find out about it, and that's great. There's nothing wrong with that, but what's wrong is that other people don't necessarily have a seat at that table. And so writing things down and making things more accessible is important. And we're still trying to do that with the website and getting things posted and all that, so it's a process. But I think those were the two things that I was most committed to.
Lester Olson was, that was something he really emphasized, was how you convince people to write things down and document the processes.
Yeah.
How do you think RSA will continue to change moving forward? Just your suspicions. Not necessarily your hopes. That's the next question. But
I guess I think that it's going to be... I think it will continue the path of becoming more and more inclusive and making that inclusivity more visible, and maybe even kind of restructuring how we think about inclusivity so that it's not, we've got this traditional thing and the other things are coming in, but there's just this space that is RSA, you know. And I think that's happening now. So I think that's a major shift, because it's it's not only a mindset of how we sort of imagine one another, but it's also a site for the kind of scholarship that can be done and imagined as, you know, crucial to the field.
Some people say that RSA is the umbrella institution for rhetoric, but it didn't start out that way.
No, it didn't.
Do you think that's an accurate description of it, though?
I do. It started out being kind of the secondary organization for a lot of people. You know, people went to CS, and that was if they were in Rec Comp, and that was sort of the primary. And if they were in Comm, they went to NCA, and then they came to RSA as a way. It was kind of a kick. It was like, oh well, let's shake this up a little bit, right? But I think as both NCA and 4Cs drifted farther and farther away from rhetoric as kind of a foundational principle. I don't know that that's a bad thing, but that just, it's what happened. I think RSA became more important to people. And so it's what was fascinating in the survey after Kendall's conference was in 2014, was that, I don't remember the statistics now, but it's, I you'll have to check with Kendall, but it's something like half of the membership now think of RSA as its primary organization. And if indeed that's the case, then the leadership has to think about the organization a little bit differently, because if it's the secondary organization, then you can count on 4Cs and NCA to provide a lot of member benefits, and that we don't have to have that responsibility. But suddenly, if we are the primary, what do we need to offer? And then the question becomes, how in offering those things do we change productively, because we don't want to like suddenly just become a shadow NCA or 4Cs. I think that defeats the purpose. So I think Michelle's got a. I think that's a challenge facing Michelle: how to change moving forward with a membership that identifies primarily here.
What do you hope will happen in terms of RSA? What do you hope the future will look like?
Well. As I mentioned in my talk last night, I hope it faces forward a little bit more. It's always been very careful in terms of making statements, and we have one of the things that when I was in leadership, we did was come up with a policy. I think it's when I was sort of the immediate past president and Kendall was president, we came up with a policy for how to respond to contemporary issues, and we didn't want to have a particular ideological agenda that we were trying to promote. That wasn't it, but we ended up saying what we would do is if something affected our membership or individual members, we would speak out on it. So for example, when Ursula Orr experienced what she experienced at ASU, when the policeman threw her to the ground and the video went viral, we responded to that. When certain people get elected, we didn't respond to that, right? And that's, I think, appropriate. But that doesn't mean then that we can't have an arm of the organization that isn't focused on this outward kind of movement. And it can be research, but it, you know, so that you're going in and doing community kind of research. It can be, but I think it also needs to be educational. I think we need to get more involved with state governments and how, you know, the Common Core or states that don't have the Common Core and have put in their own Most all of them have rhetoric in there somehow, and we ought to be in there defining how rhetoric gets taught at elementary, junior high, and high school. Rhetoric should not be something that you learn when you're a graduate student or an advanced undergraduate. It ought to be in, I think, it ought to be threaded through all the levels. And it ought to be threaded through in a more sophisticated way. I don't think we give students enough credit for what they can do. And so textbooks sometimes are too often, oh, ethos, logos, pathos, the triangle, you know, audience. And that's great. All of those things are important. But rhetoric is more complicated than that. The world is more complicated than that. And I think if we bring that approach and ground the theory in very particular things that are going on around us, then students see it. And suddenly, my hope is that they won't, that they'll understand structure. I think structure has become invisible to Americans for the most part. And so they focus at the level of claims. You're right, you're wrong, you're right, you're wrong. And if you're wrong, I vilify you. And you know, as I said last night, one of the principles of my rhetorical study with Ed Corbett was that reasonable people can disagree, right? And I also joke that you have to be very wary, my corollary says, of who defines reasonable. But still, you've got to be able to work, you know, disagree and still work together. And I think that's been lost a little bit. Not in the communities, not in the local communities. I think that happens more, but on the national level, for certain, it's become a dominant trope to vilify. And I think one way to prevent that from happening is make rhetoric more visible in the educational system. Because people just don't understand what argument is. They just don't, and that's on us.
It's become almost a bad word. Don't
it
argue.
Is. Yeah.
So this is the 50th anniversary of RSA, mm-hmm. and this is the last day of mm-hmm. the conference. Is there one memory from this particular conference, the 50th, mm-hmm. That stands out to you?
Oh, that would be hard. No, things that, it's more like a pastiche. I see images of, you know, friends laughing in the lobby. I see some of the keynotes, you know, people reminiscing. I think Andrea's talk was fabulous. I went to a panel yesterday morning at 8 a.m. About difference and how it functions in the field of rhetoric and it's more a pastiche. It's just, you know, just this engagement. Rhetoric 24/7, all day, every day.
I think that's perfect.
Okay.
We'll stop there. Okay. This is the end of the interview.